the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless, and those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind, and a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, sparked by replacing the spark in the hope the swamps of the approximate are not quite, the not yet, the not at all. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. I'm here again with our editor-in-chief, William Harrison.
How's it going?
And we're going to talk about big tech today. So it's been sort of a big day. We had the YouTube shooting. I'm sure everyone's heard about that. But this ties in pretty well with a lot of the subject matter that we've been wanting to talk about, which is why we're recording this at midnight. And so I just wanted to start, I think, by reading one of the comments the shooter had made online. I think it's sort of an interesting case because we love to pigeonhole these people as being, you know, liberals or conservatives or, you know, left or right. But the stuff she's talking about seems to be echoed, you know, in some sense on both sides. And I think it's important to actually read the firsthand material of, you know, what she had to say. And a lot of outlets might not report exactly what that is. So without further ado. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Primary sources are more important than we like to think. So with that, she wrote this comment after her YouTube channel got demonetized. So she was a YouTuber. She talked a lot about things like animal rights. She was a vegan. So, you know, few points I hadn't followed her prior. But here's what she had to say about YouTube. Be aware. Dictatorship exists in all countries, but with different tactics. They only care for short-term profits and do anything to reach their goals, even by fooling simple-minded people, hiding the truth, manipulating science, putting public mental and physical health at risk, abusing non-human animals, polluting the environment, destroying family values, promoting materialism and sexual degeneration in the name of freedom, and turning people into programmed robots. Make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. A quote from Adolf Hitler. There is no free speech in the real world, and you will be suppressed for telling the truth that is not supported by the system. Videos of targeted users are filtered and merely relegated, so that people can hardly see their videos. There is no equal growth opportunity on YouTube or any other video sharing site. Your channel will grow if they want it to. So that was the comment she made online. Any quick thoughts on that, Will?
Yeah, just a kind of abstract philosophical take on this. It's kind of the liberal narrative is really coming to a point right now in this current era. This the overall lack of meaning is eminent in that quote. She clearly has lost all sense of what's real. And that's what happens, you know, down the path of leftism, is that once there's no objective reality, then everything becomes subjective and I guess able to crumble. And so you're seeing it drive certain people crazy who can't handle it. That's what usually informs school shooters. They completely lose meaning in all parts of life, and they go and commit senseless acts of murder. And you see another example here today.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was talking more about the dictatorship sort of Google, though. So I think what she was trying to say is she was being censored. They were manipulating the truth by, you know, only showing certain takes on reality that, you know, happened after Parkland, where they, you know, took down all the videos of anyone who, you know, was saying that the kids were crisis actors. Whether you agree with that or not, you know, they're clearly curating a certain narrative. And I think maybe that's what she was trying to tap into.
Oh, for sure. I completely agree with that. I think this issue is, the issue she's mentioning here is just the catalyst. It's the excuse she uses. I think there's something deeper, but I mean, without this, who's to know whether this would happen or not? So
exactly. And we don't even know if this is, you know, the reason why she did it in particular. But I think it's interesting just to see that a lot of these things that they're doing, and they seem to think they can do it without repercussion, are affecting a lot of people. A lot of people who might have left their jobs to go full time as, you know, a YouTube content creator. And Once you do that, you know, your livelihood is completely reliant on their policies and your ability to monetize your content. And it seems like when they took that away from her, they sort of took everything.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a problem that's plaguing the entirety of YouTube. It's like you said, it's their livelihood. You know, people like PewDiePie has, you know, 55 and counting million subscribers. They rely completely on this as a job. And when you take away just 30% of that revenue, you're cutting 30% of that income, and YouTube's keeping that for itself and not distributing it because they're afraid of corporate backlash. It's completely ridiculous. The benefit of the doubt should always go to the consumer in these cases.
Yeah, it seems like they've kind of turned their back on the customer, but I guess the customer to them really is the advertisers. So, you know,
Right.
the people are just kind of the mechanism to get the advertisers to the table. They're kind of exploiting people to that end, but they also, you know, aren't really treating them with much respect.
Yeah, it's almost like a passive exploitation. It's like a under the table handshake. Like, I agree
Yeah.
that I can use your service for free and you can take all my information and sell it to the highest bidder. I
Yep,
mean, at least that's what you
exactly.
agree to when you read the terms of service, if anybody's ever read those.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's a good segue into, you know, the rest of the episode. I think we're going to talk a little bit about how these companies make money, if they should be regulated, what data they take and why they take it and how they use it, the ownership structures of companies like Twitter, Facebook, Google, and Amazon, how they got started, who sort of might be pulling the strings behind the scenes, and just other things you should know that you might not know, and just sort of a different take on these things than you might hear on all the traditional outlets. So I think the first interesting tidbit I think I'd like to start with is how Google Maps in particular got started. So there was a there's actually a CIA venture fund. It's called the InQtel Venture Fund, and it invested in a company called Keyhole. So Keyhole was eventually bought by Google and turned into Google Maps. So the CIA essentially owned a proportion of Google Maps, and they invest in a lot of seed stage companies.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so it's important because of the data that Google Maps has. So Google Maps, if you've ever looked, has little dots. There are certain views you can take, and they track essentially every move you make. What they do with that data, not a lot of people know, but they're tracking you in live time. So whenever you get those notifications that, you know, ask you if you want to enable location services, sometimes it'll say just when you're using the app. But a lot of times they'll try to get you to just enable it all the time, which means, you know, they're literally tracking you minute by minute. I know you've had some experience with the Tutor app. You
Right,
integrated
right.
some of this stuff, and is
Right, so
there
what
any?
most users don't understand when they're accepting these terms, especially with iPhone, at least that's the program with which I'm familiar. You press OK and it says you're sharing your location. Well, what does that mean? That doesn't mean your address. That means your extremely precise coordinate, latitude and longitude, means your elevation and your bearing. So it's probably the most precise, accurate piece of information you can get to describe somebody's location, and that's updating every couple of seconds in real time. Every time you move, it sends a ping to the server with your location. So not only can they track where you are now, they can track where you've been, who you've been with, who you called while you were there, and they can map out a whole event tree of what you've done in the past. And we probably don't fret because it's not the government that's doing that publicly. Obviously, they're doing that behind the scenes. But when giant corporations get to the size of the government, then it becomes a little scary.
Yeah. And so how I wanted to tie this in is Google actually has a history of working with governments in different countries to censor, you know, parts of the internet. They do it with China. They agreed to put up certain, you know, quote unquote firewalls. So it's not beyond them to make a lot of these concessions just to get that additional market share. I know how they love to
Right.
talk about not being evil, but
Do no evil.
censoring the internet of an entire, you know, 2 billion people, so that, you know, they have to consent to their laws is not what I call, you know, not evil. And so I think, you know, you probably have more knowledge about how some of the algorithms might work. I know it's, you know, super lock and key, but there does seem to be, especially when I was just doing research on a lot of this stuff, I had to go to Bing because I was trying to find some of this information about Google. You know, the CIA program, for example, the CIA fund wouldn't pop up on Google. None of my autocompletes would work. Worked fine on Bing. So it makes you wonder, you know, are they suppressing all the bad things about Google? Facebook had to come out recently and say they weren't suppressing bad stories about them, but, you know, who knows?
Google gets around that in an interesting little excuse. They say that they don't ever show anything negative. And so if you start typing something like Donald Trump or something like that, even though Google obviously hates Trump, they won't send something back that has something negative in it. That's how they get around it. And so they're allowed to manipulate these data and claim that they're objective and they don't have a hand in it. But of course they do. You know, it's all based on the things you've clicked on before and what they want you to see.
Yeah, but I think so that's interesting too. Is it curated to you specifically, or just is it taking everyone and figuring out what they assume everyone wants to see?
Well, it's a balance. Yeah, I don't know exactly how the algorithm works. I mean, they keep changing it. It's definitely not available to the public, but it's pretty much half based on web rankings. So there'll be an algorithm like a spider that'll go and find different web pages on the internet and rank them based on how many times each one links to another one. And so they'll use part of that to determine what to show you. Then they'll use your location, which they have, you know, accurately. They'll use your location history, your search history, and they're doing this all in milliseconds. It's insane. I can't even imagine writing something that would use, you know, hundreds or probably dozens of servers to calculate that in real time. But you know, what really goes on behind that firewall, nobody really knows except for the people that work at Google, I guess. But I'm sure there's something nefarious going on at least sometime.
And so if I remember correctly, the way Google has sort of structured things, they have like several large data centers around the country.
Right.
And I think you just sort of ping essentially a cache and they just pull up, you know, that web page, whichever data center is closest to you. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, essentially Google has most of the internet in those, you know, those locations. That's why you go to the dark net or you try to use DuckDuckGo and it's a nightmare to find anything because most of it, you know, is kind of kept.
Or DuckDuckGo. You know, DuckDuckGo has such promise. I tried using it a lot, but it's so hard to get around it. Google just has a monopoly by convenience almost. It's not a true monopoly, but nobody's ever going to use their alternatives unless they really, really want to.
Kind of a sidetrack. Do you think we'll ever get to the point where we can have a blockchain explorer, like a decentralized Google, but a universal blockchain explorer, where you can have, you know, parts, you know, cached in a decentralized way?
Decentralized way in caching, yes. I think once we move to protocol HTTP2, then I believe that a lot more things involving blockchain, you know, in real time, especially with transaction times and adding data to the blockchain, will become a lot more easy, a lot easier. Right now the web protocol is kind of old. It's still from the 90s. You know, everything has to agree in order for there to be consensus on the web. And so it's really, really hard to update things. But HTTP2 is, you know, I don't know the exact metrics, but it's a lot, lot faster. So it'll make transaction times a lot quicker if you're trying to add data to a blockchain, and also make it a lot easier to cache it and retrieve it. So I'd say, to answer your question, yes, but I don't know when.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's pretty much the plot of Silicon Valley this season. I think it's pretty interesting.
My question to you is it inevitable that every search engine has to develop advertising as its source for money?
Oh, absolutely not. I think it's just unimaginative. You know, all these, you have these giant tech companies that are operating under the assumption that they have to use the business models that they, you know, articulated in conception, and, you know, things change. Everyone is desperate for users, which I think is strange, because they're desperate for users purely because they want to monetize them via ads. So they're making most of their calculations based on those assumptions. But there are way better ways to monetize an individual. If you look at the ad revenue of a company, or not ad revenue, just the revenue per user of, for example, Amazon versus Google, it's, I think Amazon's average revenue per user is over $100, whereas Google's is under $1.
Right. What's the difference in users there? Is it pretty substantial, or?
Well, there's a big difference in users just because Amazon is mostly domestic, Google is worldwide. But, I mean, think about the fact that every user is paying Amazon for Amazon Prime. Well, how many users is Google actually getting $70 a year out of? I don't know. You know,
Right.
not that many. So they're, I think they've been pretty unimaginative, and I think that's something, you know, we're going to be trying to solve going forward. I think there are different ways to pay people for engagement. There are different ways to sell products. There are better ways to convince someone to buy something rather than just spamming them. I mean, pop-up ads really are just the biggest scam to advertisers themselves. So most of these
Exactly, yeah.
departments, you know, they've got some guy making these decisions saying, okay, give 5,000 to, you know, Google AdWords or whoever it is, and Google AdWords partners with some pop-up website where, you know, you're paying as these things fly all over the screen. No one's ever going to buy something from a pop-up because it's spammy and you don't trust it. So it's just literally throwing money away, and
Exactly, just
it's purposefully.
avalanches into advertising because the only way for people to make money off pop-ups is by putting more ads inside them. And so it just keeps generating more and more. And there's really no value there, which is kind of scary that so much revenue can come out of such a valueless service.
Yeah, and I think that might be why there's so much virtue si signaling up in Silicon Valley, because deep down these people realize they're not actually making the world a better place. They're not, you know, they're not doing anything that's that innovative. You look at, you know, a guy like Elon Musk versus most of these guys. He's an innovator. You know, you can't deny that. Is Twitter an innovation? You know, in some ways. The model is different. It's new. It helps people communicate in certain ways, but they've taken it and they've taken everything people like and turned it against them. They've created these sort of experiments. I mean, Facebook got caught you doing a little experiment on their own to determine if they could provably affect users' happiness. So they're literally toying with people's emotions to see if they can manipulate them. And they got caught. And, you know, it's, I don't know how people can't be angry at that, because you would think a company would want to make you feel better about yourself. But the sad thing is, because they're relying on advertisers, you actually want people to feel like shit about themselves, because you sell more stuff when people want to feel better.
I have another perspective to add to this too. I think that, and I'll play devil's advocate for a second. Not that I excuse Facebook's manipulation of user emotions, that's egregious, but I can understand why they're doing this. Facebook has been collecting data for so long. They're sitting on top of this giant mountain of unused data. It's like untapped gold, and they're just furiously trying to figure out how to combine the data types to produce some sort of meaningful output that they can use to monetize people. And so they're just going to try every. It's basically rolling the dice now. They're probably just rolling the dice and saying, "All right, let's manipulate these two fields and put them together and try to guess whether this person is going to buy this product and then try to monetize that." And it's kind of like the dilemma for every developer when you're making a database-based system. Every new data type that you add to the system, it increases the amount of work the computer has to do. But you also get the added benefit of being able to manipulate different data fields to produce, new combinations of data that might help you learn about whoever's interacting with your service. But once you have that many, and you have these probably exobytes of data that you just can't possibly seek in 1,000 lifetimes, it's kind of like you got your hands tied behind your back, even though you're swimming in a mountain of gold.
Well, and that's a pretty good interlude to my next point, which is, you know, I don't think these companies exist to make money. I think right now they're existing as an animus of control. So if you control the flow of information, you know, that's considerably more valuable to most people than $1 billion. So if you can control the sentiment of a population, you know, it doesn't matter if you have $1 trillion, you know, and you're sitting in Saudi Arabia. Most of those guys can't, you know, point at the US and say, I want these people to do this. You know, it's not that easy, but with, you know, the right tools, the right levers of control, I think it can be done. And in a little bit, we'll go more into some of the ownership structures, which I think is sort of scary. But first, I did want to talk about. So there was a post that's been circulating online. It was someone claiming to be from Google, and they said that Google has something called a human intelligence team, and they have this program called consensus cracking, where they essentially use peer pressure to manipulate people's public policy opinions or just, you know, viewpoints in general. So, and what he was saying was Google is actually the one creating these so-called Russian bots that everyone's talking about, and then they give Twitter the justification to ban a bunch of legitimate users who might, you know, might be on the other side of the aisle, who they might not want voicing their opinions. And I think if you look at a lot of, especially places like Yahoo News, you know, people just go off on these attacks, and it's a snowballing effect where you can have some civil discourse, and then all of a sudden you just see a few people just hurling, you know, generic insults, or but it's like an overwhelming amount of these people using these sort of basic phrases, you know, things you hear a lot. But with enough of them, what you can do is make someone feel like they're in the minority, force them more towards the middle, make them feel like, you know, the world's against them, which is clearly what, you know, the mass media has done with these things. They make all these issues seem like they're settled when a lot of people are very far away from consensus. So, I mean, what do you think about that?
I definitely have a lot to add about that. So I actually took a class this semester about political attitudes and public opinion, and we had a whole section during which we explored ways to manipulate survey data and survey questions in order to produce desired outputs. And when you're doing it, you know, one way where you're framing the question, it's a little more difficult to actually convince a user, especially one of, you know, average information and pretty good intelligence. You know, people are going to realize that the question is framing a context and trying to, you know, produce a desired result. But if it's the other way around and the respondent is inputting the question and you're the one who's providing the answers, like Google or the media, you have complete control over the narrative. All you have to do is just have a little tiny 1% bias, and over time that's going to propagate and help convince people to believe in your narrative. And that's why we have this, you know, seemingly this veneer of polarization in our political climate right now. I really don't think it's that divided, but the extremes are amplified so much by these companies like Twitter and CNN and MSNBC that's all we hear. And so we really perceive this milieu of discord and division where I don't really think one exists, but I don't think that facade's ever going to go away.
Yeah, I mean, so let's maybe focus on Twitter for a little bit. Mm-hmm. So Twitter is where a lot of that happens. If you look at, you know, the trending hashtags on Twitter, you almost always know, you know, what they're going to be, or, you know, you have an idea. They're never hashtagged. Even, you know, people have documented certain hashtags with significantly more posts, you know, never make it to trending if they're pushing something that clearly isn't popular. They've had people go undercover, ask some of the executives about shadow banning, and they talk about it, you know, flippantly, like it's something that happens pretty often.
Right, probably something they mention every meeting. All right, who's shadow banned today?
Exactly. Who's in our little black book? And I mean, something I think that goes back again, even to. Well, I guess I'll touch on that a little later. But as far as the data goes, I mean, all of Twitter's revenue from 2017 was made by selling data. So, you know, that's pretty crazy because it's not a profitable company. So, you know, why are people buying Twitter stock? You know, clearly major shareholders are not in Twitter to make a lot of money. They only made, I think it was something like $600 million last year. Which, you know, sounds like a lot of money, but for a tech company of that size, it's really pretty minimal. And that was revenue. So you look at companies, you know, Square, which does payments, is doing significantly better. So there's not a lot of money to be made on social media.
Including Twitter too. I think Twitter's a pretty good example of that because it's really niche. You only have you have a specific context. Everybody's just microblogging, and it's a constant spew of emotion and the completely devoid of reason. That's my take of Twitter. And so I don't know how you monetize emotion like that. You know, nobody goes to Twitter for ads. Facebook, it's easier to get in because you're taking in way more information, and so it's easier to slip it in. But with Twitter, the attention span turns into a goldfish, and you're just going from tweet to tweet to tweet and trying to make sense of it all where really none exists.
Yeah, I remember they rolled out their first ad platform. I tried using it. I mean, I actually liked it more than Facebook, at least the returns were a lot better as far as impressions, and actually downloads too, I think, for our first app. But it was interesting because the way they structured it. So the problem with Twitter is, unlike Facebook, they don't have nearly as much data on you. So you're using a username. Some people have pretty minimal profile information, so they have to go largely on what you're talking about, who you're following. So you can target certain keywords, certain sentiments, which I thought was an interesting idea. So you can have ads that are more timely, more relevant to what you want now. So if you tweeted, "Man, I'm hungry," you can have, an ad for Papa John's, which, I think is cool. I think a lot of companies have made pretty clever use out of Twitter, to sell their own products for public outreach.
Twitter is great for the consumer. I think it's a really excellently developed system, but I think the fatal error they made was trying to copy Facebook's monetization system. Facebook and Twitter have completely separate philosophies. Facebook's idea is you have a community where everybody knows and verifies each other. With Twitter, when you make an account, it almost encourages like pseudonymity, really not complete anonymity, but you don't have to put your real name, you don't have to verify your information. You're not friending people to see them and see updates for them as a person that you can be whoever you want. And that's a lot harder for advertisers to buy into, I think, or at least consistently, because they don't there's kind of like a fuzzy layer in between, your real identity and then your Twitter profile. That doesn't exist with Facebook.
Yeah. And I mean, the problem really, though, I think what people aren't paying attention to is the problem, I don't think, just generally, is that advertisers don't know customers. I mean, they clearly do. And I mean, I think that's fine for the most part. I think, I don't mind getting targeted ads. It's at least relevant.
Yeah, as long
But
as
I
they
think,
help me, I don't care. I mean,
yeah,
I know what I'm signing up for.
exactly. You're the product, if you're not paying. But I think the problem is these companies don't know their advertisers, so they're getting a
Good
lot
point.
of spam. They're getting, they'll take anyone's money, and that's why is anyone in Russia could have just put up a bunch of Facebook ads, just like we could put up ads in Russia during their elections. They've become this foreign campaign finance machine. Who needs a super PAC when you can just spend money on Facebook ads, right?
Right.
And if you look at campaign finance law, there's some interesting loopholes that Trump did a great job of getting around, but it's still the law that if you're on primetime television, you and your opponent need to be given an equal platform, so an equal amount of time. If you're formally speaking, doing interviews, it has to be sort of a fair platform, I guess. So,
Right.
but what Trump did pretty cleverly is he just became newsworthy, and got a whole lot more airtime, just because he made things interesting and he kind of took advantage of the narrative I think they were trying to spin, but used it to destroy them in the sense that he was able to shed light on a lot of the things that they were doing that they would never admit to, and that most people wouldn't believe until they really saw it play out. And I think he's still doing that. I think in a lot of ways, he's been on this mission to sort of prove to people not to trust them. And you see a lot of people who do take everything they hear as fact. And I can't blame them. I mean, my mom is one of them, but it's kind of scary because they get caught lying a lot and they never own up to it. They seem to just double down for the most part.
Oh yeah, it's crazy. And I thought it was always exaggerated, fake news this, fake news that, right? It's I thought it was just a buzzword. Recently though, I actually went back and watched a lot of clips, probably a good 30 or 40 videos of just constantly day after day them getting something wrong, and they know that it's wrong. You can see it in their face. They know what they're saying is ridiculous. These people on CNN, like Brian Stelter, if you've ever seen him, or Rachel Maddow, or that guy, what's his name, Lawrence McDonald, the guy that freaked out about the hammering. I think they have to know what they're saying is ridiculous. And just every day they get away with little things, and everybody's so, they've got the horse blinders on watching CNN and MSNBC. And I'm not including them, solely the left. Fox News is the same problem, but there's just more outlets on the left. And back to what your point about Trump using the media. Do you remember when I think it was right after his election? There were a lot of people comparing on the left comparing it to 9/11. Do you remember that? I thought it was complete. I mean, it's still ridiculous.
There's
I
the Holocaust too.
So. Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, that's obvious. Yeah. But recently I've begun to empathize with them because what happened in 9/11 was that the terrorists took our technology, Western civilization, and turned it against itself. They took our planes, our advanced plane technology, and flew it into our financial center, and then the media was fixated on it, and broadcasted 3,000 people crumbling to death, over the course of an entire day. So they completely used our own apparatus against us.
Oh yeah.
And what you have here is I can totally see why they think this is like 9/11, because Trump completely flipped the entire liberal media apparatus around on its head by they exploited all the weaknesses that the left had established by propaganda and these giant corporations, because they thought only they knew how to play it. Only they were smart enough in the leftist elitist arrogance. Only they were smart enough to use it to manipulate. And once somebody snuck in the back door and they couldn't stop it, of course they freak out. It's their personal 9/11. That's just a random tangent, but I thought that was funny.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think it's like, leftist elitist arrogance. I've grown up around, I live 20 minutes from Hollywood, so a lot of my friends, they've got parents who are producers and directors. And some of it, I think, is arrogance. A lot of it, I think, is putting your head down and just kind of doing your job. Most people aren't willing to, take the path with resistance. There aren't a lot of people willing to stand up and fight or lose their job over.
Yeah, it's against their best interest to do so.
Exactly. But I think with that in mind, if those people aren't to blame, then who is really pulling the levers? And that's why I wanted to get into a couple cases here. So we've talked a little bit about the Saudi prince Alawid bin Talal. He was the one who was recently detained in Saudi Arabia by the new crown prince.
The new one being the reformer, right?
Yes, correct. Okay. So he was accused of all sorts of financial crimes. But I think it's interesting to look at his portfolio. So here's what he owns. He owns 5% of Twitter, 5% of Apple, 5%, or I'm actually not sure about the Snapchat number. He didn't disclose that, but good percentage of Snapchat. Which is a terrible investment, and I don't think he's a stupid guy. He's got a several trillion dollar fund. Time Warner, 5%, and News Corp, 5%. And these are investments he's had for 20 years. And so here's a breakdown of what Time Warner alone owns. So first, 5% of a company, especially a companies these sizes, is a massive amount of control. Yeah,
almost unimaginable.
Yeah, so if you're in a boardroom, you're making all the decisions at that point. No one else has even close. See, if you have 5% of Apple, what is that? At least $20 billion, probably more than that now. This guy is playing with more money than most of these, even the founders of these companies can imagine. He's got more equity than most of the founders. But here's what Time Warner alone owns. So Time Warner, as far as their TV division, they own CNN, HBO, the CW, all of Warner Brothers, Cartoon Network, Boomerang. So they own, the news, kids programming, movies, Warner Brothers, and
studio.
Family TV. As far as the internet goes, they own AOL, NBA.com, PGA.com, the NCAA.com. So I guess they own the digital rights to most of these sports leagues. In their music production, they have Green Day signed, Mac Miller, Prince, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, pretty much anyone who's anybody. And News Corp, which he also owns 5% of, owns the Daily Telegram, the New York Post, the Wall Street Journal, Market Watch, Fox, FX, Nat Geo, Hulu. So when you combine that with Snapchat and Twitter and Apple, and I'm sure he has more investments, that's pretty much all the news, most of the media channels. Even, Hulu, which we like to think of as not being a typical media channel, which is jointly owned with Disney. All these, sports leagues, which we've seen a lot of interesting bias on. A lot of these issues are being brought up on those.
Right.
And, you know, music. So, like, all of these people who control the broad consensus of our society essentially answer to one guy in Saudi Arabia. So he's deciding the direction of these companies. You know, things to think about, like Twitter. Jack Dorsey left for a little bit. Someone new stepped in. Jack Dorsey came back all of a sudden. Right now, Time Warner, or actually since it was 2016, so during the election, AT&T tried to buy out Time Warner. AT&T is a little different. So their ownership structure, they're entirely owned by the founders for the most part, not entirely the Pupco, but the biggest shareholders are all the founders. And Trump seems to have some sort of relationship, I think, with AT&T. They've been putting out things about the Internet Bill of Rights, which I think is something he has been trying to back channel in. And the DOJ right now is actually trying to use Trump as a mechanism of preventing the merger. So, I mean, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but there's got to be more to the story.
What's your personal take? Would you vote against it or for it?
Well, I mean, it's hard. I mean, AT&T is a megalith. They own DirecTV. They own tons of cellular. There's really no good.
There's there are no more great cases against, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it. I agree. I think, I mean, with what happened in Saudi Arabia, the prince, I think, had to divest most of his holdings. So I don't know if that's as much of a problem anymore. Who knows? But yeah, I don't think these companies need to get that big. And I think it's really scary when you, I mean, the number of pages I had to get through to track these different companies all back to their parents, because each of these divisions, you know, the TV division is its own company. And then within it, you have CNN. And within CNN, you have 10 other companies. You know, it's these crazy structures where it takes forever to get to the top.
I'm sure you've seen that big structure, that tree of all the, like, the six big corporations that own basically every brand. Have you seen that
yeah.
graph? We got to put
yeah.
that up on the website. It's a pretty yeah. Chilling information. Yeah, and to the rational skeptic out there who's thinking, you know, what's the big deal? It's a free market. So what, that one guy owns 5%? He's rich. I think at the very least, it's evident that this just proves that, you know, control of a meta narrative in a corporate structure is at least possible. You know, not going as far as to prove it, just the fact that he owns a major share, you know, rivaling basically yeah. other investment groups with his ownership percentage. Well, this just means that it's possible for control to be, you know, affected in companies.
Yeah, I mean, why do you need spies if you can just buy all the companies that have all of our data and look through it, you know?
Yeah, why use Talk a drone about... flying overhead that's not going to be very accurate at, you know, analyzing somebody's face when you have Snapchat that can create a depth map of your face stored yeah. in a database?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so who knows? The entire government of Saudi Arabia and whoever else they wanted to tell, you know, might have perfectly rendered images of all of our faces alongside everything we've ever put on our Twitters, or our Snapchat accounts, or our iPhones. You know, it's crazy when you realize what sort of a picture they can paint. And I think that leads us nicely into Facebook. In my opinion, I think the Cambridge Analytica sort of scandal was actually a plant by the Trump administration. Because if you look at the way he took it, one, he didn't really push back. He admitted to it and he sort of owned it. He said, well, you guys aren't telling me I'm behind on the tech side now, are you? And so he's kind of scoffing at the fact that everyone thought that the Clinton campaign was so far ahead of him, but, you know, he actually had some smart guys. And with Cambridge Analytica, so one thing I noticed is one of the reasons they had access to all this data is it was because they had essentially archived it before they had made certain policy changes. I mean, I think, do you remember when that happened, when we were working on our first app, Guru?
And yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. I believe that was 2013, early 2014 at the latest. And they changed the terms of service for the developers. I think they restricted access, or at least how much you could Because you can't just sign up for a Facebook account or a Facebook developer account and then send a trillion requests to the server and just copy everything you want and bring it back. They wanted to stop people doing that. You probably should, because you're losing a lot of money going out the door if you just sell that out for free. Yeah. But yeah, continue.
So, well, I actually want to get in. So what kind of data are they typically giving developers access to, like before and after, for example?
Interesting. So it really depends on what kind of service you're building. For something like Uber, and you just need the bare bones information like email, maybe friends, so you could lower your cost per cost per user acquisition. It's really just a tool of facilitating login and user storage, because it's kind of like a principle among developers that if somebody else has already built it out there, chances are it's better than what you could do. So just try to use that, which is why a lot of apps use Facebook login. But when you're using the app, if you authorize them to access your entire profile, what they can do is they can look into your entire past with Facebook, all your posts, all your friends, you know, probably your friends' friends, depending on the access you're granted. And people can build a pretty accurate description of you that's just sitting in a cloud, just sitting there idle. You know, they're probably never even going to use it, but it's just the potential energy of it sitting there to generate revenue is why they keep it. And when third-party developers sign up with Facebook, they request access to that, and they try to keep it too because they want to monetize or at least gather information like Cambridge was. I personally believe that this thing is nothing more than a nothing burger. I think, you know, the fact that people are surprised at this is almost ridiculous. It's ludicrous.
It's pretty sad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's... Yeah.
And then so, you can see that the whistleblower that came out, he didn't even work there during the alleged scandal. He quit before the campaign. So, yeah, he even admitted, okay, this is kind of hearsay. This is going to give you a rundown of something that I have access to information to, because they're not going to come out and verify it. So he can tell whatever he wants to.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, so one of, you know, we kind of found out the hard way when we discovered this app called Lulu, which was a platform where you'd log in with your Facebook. The app would import all of your male friends. Only women could log into the app. And then you could rank all of the men in your life, men you've had relationships with. You could rank them on attributes like attractiveness and, you know, sexual ability, things like that. And girls were actually using this to sort of dig up information on guys. But Facebook was just handing all this information over to this third-party developer so that they could, you know, give people the tools to, you know, essentially, it was a sort of libelous behavior in a lot of ways. People couldn't defend themselves. They were, you know, there's a public record being put out without their consent and their information as well.
It's almost slanderous at some point. And this is actually a really great segue into a point I wanted to bring up before we met. And that is that it's really funny how all these corporations, like Twitter, all these media corporations and Facebook, and even like Lulu, the perfect example, they absolve themselves of all responsibility and say, well, we're not a news corporation. We're not a news group. We're not curtailing the news for people. We're not curtailing user behavior. We're just, you know, passively making sure nobody says any death threats. And so when they say that, they're allowed to get away with users accepting liability of what they post. But once a company starts manipulating, using algorithms to favor user information above other user information in a way that might be perceived to be biased, then you lose all of that indemnity as a corporation, where you can just say that you're going to Pontius Pilate it and pretend like nothing's going on when really, you know, you're behind the scenes manipulating things. So what are your thoughts on that? What do you think? How do you think the regulatory state should interfere? Do you think it should interfere, one, and how so, if you do?
I don't think they should interfere. I think there should just be better alternatives, which is, you know, what we're kind of trying to do. But better alternatives for everyone involved. So they've just sort of shoehorned themselves into the middle of these conversations, into the middle of these interactions. So, you know, most people go to these platforms to follow someone, someone they, you know, whose content they enjoy. So, you know, YouTube, everyone goes to YouTube, not because they love sitting on the YouTube homepage, but because they like the content that's on there and specific to certain people. And all they're doing is creating the platform, you know, selling ads to fund it, which is fine. You know, if people want a free service, that's not a bad way to do it. But then they're deciding, you know, certain viewpoints are not allowed, and they're trying to weaponize the data they have on people to make them think a certain way, which I think is very scary. It's straight out of 1984. It's almost like they used it like a blueprint. And a lot of people think it's not intentional. I don't know. Maybe the culture really just is, and I'm sure this accounts for a good amount of it. It's just, it's cultural hegemony where people want to fit in and think a certain way.
I don't think it even has to be intentional. I think it just has to be a little bit of, you know, imperceptible bias among a few key people. And that's just going to resonate. Of course, I actually do think that there is some sort of narrative that they're trying to push. I mean, that part is clear to me. But even if they weren't, I mean, it's just analyzing human behavior. It's obvious that when you get a group of people that think alike together, then the platform they offer is going to facilitate that kind of belief.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think I might think differently if some of their behavior was different, like the way they acted in other countries. I think we should be looking at the way companies act in other countries and realize they're doing the same thing with our intelligence agencies and our government. And
you're talking about like Twitter complying with what's his name, Erdogan in Turkey to block certain people in the country.
Exactly. You know, if they're cutting these deals there, they're doing the same here. I mean, for all this worry about Russian collusion, I mean, the CEO of Alphabet was born in Moscow. you've got Eric Schmidt going to North Korea like twice since 2013. Why is he in North Korea, a country without internet, really? And I don't think it was to bring a free and open internet to the North Korean people. I just have a hard time believing that.
Do no evil against your investors.
Yeah, well, I mean, the investors aren't even making very good money. They're not a very profitable company for the most part. But
Alphabet.
Yeah, Alphabet. Mm-hmm. But back to Facebook. So after the scandal, it was revealed that Zuckerberg had sold 1.14 million shares in the 2 weeks prior, which is something interesting. It seems to think that he knew something was coming. And I don't know if he knew that this specifically was coming, but I think he could tell that they were going to start getting hammered. Maybe Trump was coming after them. I mean, I think a lot of this is Trump or Trump's team or, you know, someone in his camp purposefully making it hurt for these companies. And I think for good reason, because they're getting exposed for a lot of things that I think they should. And interestingly enough, the way he sold these shares is, so he's created something called the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, which sounds like a charity, but it's actually an LLC. So while parading around like a charity, they've essentially just created a shell corp for them to funnel all of Zuckerberg's shares into, which he still has full control of as per diem of the document. And the LLC can spend money on things like lobbying, political donations. It doesn't have to disclose its pay to executives. So, you know, Zuckerberg could take every dime and just pay himself back if he wanted to.
But wait, really, 10 years ago, Zuckerberg said he doesn't care about money. So,
yeah, you're right. Clearly.
Yeah, if he didn't care about money, why would he sell all those shares and make a $500 million profit?
Yeah, right before the stock lost $50 billion in value.
Yeah, coincidence, probably.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think a lot of people worry that, you know, some of these foreign actors in the elections are purposefully subverting campaign finance laws, and a lot of the executives are complicit in it. And it's kind of an interesting parallel to draw this specific situation with like the Equifax hacks, for example, where literally everyone's social security numbers were were leaked. They're still being sold on the dark net. I mean, there are actually companies trying to sell additional services in the form of notifications if your social pops up on the dark net. So it's such a problem that, you know, and now that everyone's social is out there.
I've seen those advertised. I wonder how effective that is. Yeah, we'll just scan the dark net. Yeah, I'm sure. Go ahead and try that.
Oh, yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, sounds easy. Exactly. But really, it was the reception that was interesting because people really didn't care. It was played down a lot. Maybe people don't understand how credit scores work and what kind of information they have on you.
Determines your life, essentially.
Yeah.
At least in the future.
Yeah, certainly. Maybe it's because everyone got hacked, so it was kind of like no one got hacked. I guess it's almost different when you feel like you're in the boat with everyone else, as opposed to you're in this dichotomy where two opposing camps are competing in a place like an election, and you feel like your data was stolen to, coerce you into something. And that's kind of how this story was sold. And I think they were trying to spin it so that it hit Trump harder than it hit Facebook, and they failed pretty miserably at that. And I was actually surprised that they failed. I thought they were going to take it in Trump's direction. But I think enough people realized that this is just kind of how you play the game.
I mean, every partisan loves when the other party infights, and that's exactly what the left and Facebook are doing right now. I don't understand it at all why they're blaming Facebook. I feel bad for, Mark Zuckerberg. He is a lizard. I'll give him that. So I don't really feel too bad for him. I don't think he should be CEO of Facebook. I think he's too socially awkward and doesn't know what he's doing as an executive. As a programmer, I think he's brilliant, but they shouldn't. Programmers should not be the executives of companies, in my opinion.
I mean, I think he did a good job of building it into a behemoth business. I mean, he did a great job of monetizing it before, companies like Google were really figuring it out. They did a really great job in the beginning, but they just took it too far. I think he just didn't know when to stop. And so you got to this point of micro-targeting where, the returns are diminishing at some point, I'm sure, and people are just getting inundated with more and more crap they don't want to deal with, don't want to see, fewer and fewer interactions with actual people, actual friends, more of this isolation. And now it seems like instead of just admitting that they're wrong or they went too far, things got out of hand, they crack down with s like fact checkers is what they call it for fake news. And a fact checker, I mean, who do you determine are the arbiters of truth so much as to decide what is fact and what is not for the entire country? Because
They're attack. Yeah, these are debunkers were debunking memes, and they were debunking satirical pieces. There's one that said it was a satire piece. I forgot the name of the actual publisher of it. It was a hilarious title. It says CNN buys industrial sized washing machine to spin news better, and it goes through a whole. And there's like a Photoshop picture of a washing machine with a CNN logo on it, and it goes into detail about how cautiously they spin the news. And of course, Facebook put a strike on that page and says, You were recently caught sharing, or something that's not verbatim. You were recently caught sharing this fake news article, and it has a link to it. It just looks so ridiculous, a screenshot. But this is what happens when you have so much data that you have to hand over, really complex tasks that seem simple to us, like, determining whether something is satirical or realistic. And you're giving that power to an algorithm, which uses so much more, it's so much less efficient in that kind of contextualized data gathering and analysis than we are. And Facebook's like, okay, we're going to try to be neutral and hand it off to the algorithms. Okay, well, yeah, Facebook developed the algorithms, though, so you're not handing it off to anybody but yourselves.
And it seems like they've taken the worst approach to it, where it seems their strategy is we're going to let our algorithms cast a wide net, and then we're going to let some really biased people determine what is okay and what is not. And so you get the worst of both worlds, where it's pretty likely you're going to get some bias and you're going to get some bad decisions being made. And these are the kind of things that can, lead someone to not having a job, losing their income, losing, I think most importantly, probably for the woman who was involved in the shooting earlier, it's losing your identity. A lot of the YouTubers I know, that community is their identity. It's their entire life. They spend their whole day interacting with these people, putting up videos. And if that's your thing, and then some, supposedly omniscient force decides that that's no longer okay. One of the things she was complaining about was she had a workout video that got censored for nudity, because her abs were showing. And where do you draw the line? Because there are a lot of problems. In so much as it's just not consistent. And I think that's really my answer to the regulatory question you had earlier. The regulation shouldn't force them to do anything specifically, but it should force them to be even-handed. So if you have a privacy policy that states certain things, you can't selectively enforce. You have to state a policy once everyone knows the rules they're working under, and they create their channel and their business around this subset of rules. don't go start changing the rules or changing the meaning of the words within the rules, because then you're going to have chaos. No one's going to know what's okay and what's not okay.
Right.
And that seems to be happening a lot.
Principally, I'm against regulation in all of its forms. And I think that in this case, I don't want regulation enacted because it never works in preventing monopolies from getting bigger, or at least whatever it seeks out to fix, it always does the exact opposite. Any antitrust behavior by the government, it achieves the opposite always. And so if they try to regulate, you know, speech in the news media, what they do, they just set a really hard, a tough barrier to entry into competition and allow these giant behemoth corporations that have the ability, the capital and the user base to be able to afford these new regulations. They'll just keep growing. And at places like outlets like Gab and some of the other similar ones on the right, the alt media, or not even just on the right, you know, anything that challenges the status quo of the uniparty, you know, exaggerating a bit there. But anything that does that, you're going to have a barrier to entry that's going to be really hard to surpass. Where I do support regulation, however, is anything that uses AI to determine, you know, your equity or your status as a user in a company. You know, it's probably a good thing. I used to, over the past couple months or so, in trying to learn how to develop AI, I've kind of adopted this bug that, oh my gosh, it's going to kill us all. And I still think, you know, 500 years down the line, maybe possible. But right now, the fact that AI is so distributed and kind of, it's inaccurate in a sense. I remember watching this video that there's this program that tried to determine if a picture contained a wolf. And over time, the AI, which self-adjusts in order to make better analysis, more efficient, effective analysis, it'll self-adjust the weights that, you know, should I look for the ears to determine it's a wolf, or should I look to the snout? And it'll subtly adjust itself over the course of trials to produce a better and more consistent output. And over time, what this AI did was, instead of trying to find a wolf, it looked for pictures with snow. And so if you input a picture with snow, you'd have a high likelihood that it would be marked as containing a wolf regardless.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a funny example, but when you apply that to companies that are manipulating terabytes of data in order to make complex decisions about, you know, which news story gets prioritized, you know, you might end up getting the exact opposite of what you promised or what you want to see. And so I support regulation in that field a bit. I think the EU, that's the only thing they're doing right now, is protecting people against the threat of developers who develop poor AI.
Yeah, I mean, in the EU right now, they're actually proposing a tax on big tech companies. They call it I forget the specific term they used. It was a turnover tax, I think. So it more specifically applies to big tech companies with several hundred million dollars in revenue, but it'll be a 3% flat tax on all those companies. I know they're pushing back pretty hard against it, but, you know, this ties well into what has been happening this week with Amazon. Trump has been laying into them pretty bad because, you know, Amazon, I have some respect for, because the way they've expanded is intelligent. They've taken advantage of certain loopholes, and I think you should always try and find the path of least resistance, do things smart. But they have done so at the expense of the taxpayer, which is why I think it's okay for someone who's there, you know, so the warden of the taxpayer to push back against those things.
I think he was going to go and start talking about the USPS.
The Postal Service is subsidized.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, sorry to lose you.
Yeah, I think the microphone broke up on your side of it. I just wanted. Are you still there?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, so the problem is the USPS is heavily subsidized by the US taxpayer. That's why you go in, you can send a package flat rate pretty much anywhere in the US for like $6. You go to FedEx or UPS and you're paying significantly more than that. And that's just because it's subsidized. So a company, the biggest company, it is the biggest company, and the company that ships the most things, Amazon probably ships more packages than the rest of the United States combined in a given day.
The biggest customer of the post office.
Yeah, oh, I'm sure by far.
By far, yeah.
Yeah, and so at what point is the government just subsidizing companies? And when you also... Go ahead.
I think in this case, go ahead and finish your point, then I'll comment on what you
just
said. Sure.
And it's reinforced by the fact that Amazon also isn't paying local sales tax. So it's only two states, I think California and New York, where Amazon has to pay a sales tax for goods shipped. So Amazon has been able to undercut pretty much all of their competitors because they have an extra 4 to 9% margin on all sales to play with. I mean, that's the margin most stores use to survive. And they've gotten away with not paying that.
Yeah, back to what you're saying about the USPS, I think this is definitely a problem, but I take a more free market approach. I think it's the inverse. I think that Amazon is subsidizing the USPS because it's true that the USPS has made a lot of concessions to Amazon, business concessions that they probably wouldn't have otherwise made, like maybe extending hours on the weekend. But I'm trying to envision a kind of a world where Amazon did not exist and all of that revenue didn't go to the post office. I feel like the post office would collapse. You remember when they dropped off Saturday at one point? This is like probably 10 years ago, or maybe 8 years ago. They stopped delivering on Saturday. And then after a while, they reinstated that. And I think that was because of Amazon. But I think that if we don't watch out over time, that balance is going to grow into an imbalance. Amazon's going to have direct control over a government corporation. So I think that, you know, it's essentially almost completely independent from oversight. So might as well cut the cord and put it into the free market. That's what I say. I say privatize the post office. I mean, I don't want to sound like a typical free market person, but, you know, what works, works.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of e-commerce. I've, for the most part, been very impressed with the post office. You know, not necessarily the people you meet at the front desk. But as far as shipping operations, they're pretty efficient, and they've really improved the speed at which they get things out, the tracking capabilities. I think they have done a pretty good job, and I think e-commerce has driven a lot more revenue their way.
Right.
But I don't think more sales equals more revenue. I think because they're taking essentially what is a loss on every package, it's actually worse to have, you know, a big customer like Amazon. And from a constitutional perspective, I wanted to get your perspective. If you were going to abolish it, isn't having the post office in the Constitution?
So, it's a good point, actually, a really good point. The language is pretty ambiguous. It's more like the post office is an implication of congressional authority. You have a section, I think it's Section 8, the enumerated powers of Article 1. It says that the Congress will have the ability to collect taxes for post roads and establish post roads throughout the country. And so the implication of that is that, of course, a post office, like, why would you have roads if you didn't need a post office? So that's where Congress gets the authority to run it. Right now, I believe I don't know when this change happened. I believe this is, you know, in the late 1900s, late 1970s, the USPS was about to fail. And so they made it, a government corporation. And what that entails is that it's not completely independent. So you have a little bit of free marketism in how it actually works in terms of oversight. And so the board has essentially complete control over it instead of Congress, which has minimal authority. But you also have that government interference of the bureaucracy at the low level. So, you know, it's a really bad mixture. I think it takes kind of like the worst parts of the free market and the worst parts of the government and puts them into one corporation, you know, like a government corporation, two words that everybody should hate together.
Yeah.
And so constitutionally, to answer your question, I think there wouldn't be a single problem with contracting private entities to run the post office, giving, you know, managerial control, as long as the federal government retains its, you know, duly granted oversight capabilities over government entities.
It seems like you could almost subvert that by giving everyone access to the internet. So if you had the internet as a mechanism of communication, but it was a free and open internet, then the government wouldn't need to use paper as, you know, a method of communication.
Right. I think, you know, FedEx and UPS have done so much of a better job historically and consistently since they were founded. That should just be a clear indicator that the free market does this better. And it's funny, actually, if you were to ship, if a criminal were trying to ship drugs out to his, you know, his customers, he's not going to use UPS. He's not going to use FedEx because their security is extremely good. Because they're liable if something gets shipped that's not supposed to be shipped. You send it through the post office. You know, it's just everybody's just trying to pass it on to the next person, so you can get away with doing a lot of things. It's kind of an ironic statement of privacy there.
Yep.
Privacy from incompetence.
It's an extra felony, so you're doubling down because you're illegally shipping something through a federal institution becomes a federal crime and
across state lines. Oh yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It adds a few.
You belong to the government at that point.
Yeah, exactly. You might be working at the post office.
Exactly, that'd be the perfect punishment.
Yeah, it really would. So, I want to touch lastly on a company, you're very familiar with, that sort of stands apart from a lot of these other institutions, and I think there's been a conscious effort for them to do so. The company is Apple. So Apple has taken some very public stands on privacy protection. I think it's really smart. I think if there was a company to do that, Apple is smart to, things like the shooting in San Bernardino when they refused to let the FBI unlock that iPhone. Of course, a company came out recently with a little box that'll do it for them, and now they're going to buy a bunch of those boxes. So the taxpayer is not winning in that one. But, there are some things I wanted to get your take on. So a lot of people think iPhones are fairly secure. I like to think so. I hope so. I think iMessage has end-to-end encryption,
Correct.
but I do know that Snowden refuses to use iPhones specifically. It's something he's talked about. I don't know if you trust what he has to say, but I think that's an interesting point that he went out of his way. And something I've heard about as well is that BlackBerry was one of sort of the last holdouts as far as government backdoors, and that's one of the reasons why they were sort of forced into the ground, which seems, possible. Of course, they weren't innovating much, but I'd imagine they'd want to take down anyone, not playing ball.
So briefly to touch on Snowden, is definitely a good question to ask me. I used to, ask me 4 years, 3 or 4 years ago, I would have defended Snowden for every single day, 24/7. However, now I go back and watch these documentaries of him and watch exactly what he released, go through the files, and I've lost a lot of faith in him. I think that he's not trustworthy. I think that what he leaked didn't really incriminate the government in a way that he wanted it to, or the way that people think or assume. So I think, like, right now his basic duty, his daily function, is to purvey mistrust in the government. And so when you see the Apple logo on one of the slideshows that he released and say, "Oh, look, Apple's in cahoots with the government," that doesn't, I mean, it looks scary, and I agree that it's bad, but you don't get the full picture there. It might just be that the government is targeting these companies, saying, "All right, these are the biggest companies. They have the most data. We're going to try to see if we can work out a deal where we get access to their back door to their server." I think some of it's nefarious, but I don't think that everything that he released was such a bombshell that he made it out to be. And that's why I don't agree with him. I'm such an Apple fanboy, so anybody that says something against Apple, I'm probably in a distrust. But I think that even if Apple isn't the beacon of privacy that they claim to be, I think that it's good for the society that at least they're pretending to be at the very worst case, because it's clearly working for them. I really think they're honest about this, because at Apple, this is an example where corporate narratives actually do good in some cases. Apple's corporate narrative is user experience. And you're going to have a bad user experience if you're inundated with ads that make you feel like you're being watched every time you open Safari. And so Apple keeps such a lock and key on everything that they allow access to developers, or whether it's, inside their own facility and combating the US government in a privacy case that you mentioned with James Comey a couple years ago. Your take?
Yeah, I mean, they run a tight ship, so I definitely agree on that point. I mean, I think I would rather live naively and assume that they're protecting all of my data, because where would I go, honestly? I'm not going to go back to a flip phone. I just can't function in the 21st century trying to run a company.
I mean,
It's not possible.
I think that the proof of the pudding is in eating it, and in using the iPhone, you're not hit with a bunch of ads. Siri is lacking severely behind all of its competitors, and that, even though it's kind of like a bad thing for the company, because it's not truly AI, not even close at all. It's just, I guarantee it's the Siri functions are just a bunch of arguments that try to, compare words, like if this word equals this. It's not true AI. If Apple were taking information and selling it to people behind our backs and not telling us about it, all of these services would be so much better at predicting what we want to do. I mean, Apple has so much data access, but I think the problem is twofold. One, they don't want to do it, and two, they probably don't know how to. I don't think they know how to actually use the data they have. That's edited through Siri's complete.
Yeah, the HomePod. I know some guys that worked at Apple, and it's absolute garbage.
I feel bad for the people that designed, because the speakers system is phenomenal. I mean, the amount of technology in that is crazy. And then you put it, and they're like, okay, well, we did the best job we could possibly do. They handed over the Siri team, and like, you can't even detect somebody's different voice. Like, you can't use Spotify with it. It's an absolute failure.
It's crazy. Yeah. Like, I think Google was really smart to put out the functionality where you can pair multiple Bluetooth speakers now, because like, how many Bluetooth speakers does the average person have? And like, shouldn't you be able to just put those all around your house and play a bunch of music? You know, it seems so obvious. But
yeah, I'm surprised we don't live in more of a Bluetooth intensive world. I mean, Bluetooth is such an innovative technology. It's just a single channel, and you're sending really small packets of data. And a lot of these Internet of Things places, like speakers and things inside your home, operate really efficiently in those kind of streams of data. And I'm just surprised that companies like Apple don't take more advantage of these near field communication abilities like Google does. Google's really good at that. I'll give them credit. So is Amazon. I think the Alexa is probably leading its field in that case. However, I would never purchase one.
Yeah.
My parents actually bought one, the Google Home. What's it called? HomePod?
Yeah.
No, that's the Apple one.
Google Home.
Google Home. They put it in the living room, and it would just randomly turn on because it's next to the TV. And my parents just got freaked out over time. And I told them this horror story about how Alexa testified against in a murder case against its owner. And after that, next time I came home and flew back to Dallas, it was gone. So it's pretty funny.
I mean, that's what a lot of people, and this is one last point I forgot to talk about earlier. Facebook Messenger, for example. So a lot of people have looked at Facebook Messenger and said that, you know, there's more sophisticated spy software in there than most like actual hacking programs. Most of the like programs released in like Vault 7 of like WikiLeaks, where they went into all the programs that the CIA had in the backdoor.
For spoofing their the profiles. Yeah.
Yeah, but they're I was reading about how a lot of the stuff in Facebook Messenger is more advanced than that. I mean, Facebook put out this standalone app. I've so many times been talking about a name and they'll come up in my Facebook or with Google. You know, you write certain things in a Google Doc and they own all of it. Like they can look through your docs. You know, there is no privacy when you're using any of these services, and people have sort of forgotten about that. And there's also, you know, an eternal history of what you've done. If you go into your Facebook and hit the little button that's been going around the compile all my data. I did that years ago and I got hundreds of pages and I couldn't believe it. But it made me very aware of all the stuff they're keeping, every picture you've ever sent in a message. And I think it's just as likely all of these HomePod type devices, probably Apple's, are logging everything we do and say in the interim. And who knows what they're doing with it, if they're doing anything with it, or what they'll do with it when they decide to use it or sell, you know, to who knows. They might be selling these to foreign companies, which means they're selling them essentially to foreign governments. And something our own government has done openly is something called the Five Eyes program, which is pretty interesting. So the U.S. government, to subvert the limits on surveillance, domestic surveillance programs, has established a treaty of sorts that's been around since after World War II, where we share data with certain partners, so five different partners. It's England, Australia, and Canada, and one more. I forget which one. New Zealand, interestingly enough.
All the English-speaking countries.
And so they have sort of two mechanisms. The PRISM program, which gathers user information from tech firms Google, Apple.
Passive collection one.
Microsoft, And then they have upstream systems that gather information directly from fiber cables. So, you know, we have these giant cables under the Atlantic, and they're just tapping these giant international cables and getting all of the information that's going. So, you know, these governments have been complicit in sharing information about each other's citizens to subvert their own laws about doing so,
This play, yeah, this plays really well into what I was saying earlier about Edward Snowden. The Prism is a perfect example of that. It's really interesting when you look at actually how communications work with ISPs and with the government. The government leases out airspace to corporations, these media groups, these ISPs, and then they use the airways to transmit data. So at the end of the day, the government can just put a satellite up and stick. Well, it's this, you know, the United States is sovereign. We're allowed to collect whatever's in the air, and so they just stick a satellite up there. And there's no way that can be proved out in court. I mean, that's clearly within
fishing
the
capabilities. For data.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what's to say they can't? Who's to say they can't do that? And it's kind of scary that, you know, there's even if it was something that I thought was terrible and outrageous, I think it's kind of scary that there's no remedy for that. There's no way that the majority could say, we don't want this happening. Because you could just put up a satellite in somebody's backyard and nobody would know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I'm going too down the rabbit hole with this one. But, I mean, something I've been following since October, the QAnon posts on 4chan, right. Which is something they recently talked about on Roseanne, which I think is interesting. So that, to me, is sort of phase two, where they're appealing to a broader audience. And, you know, it's entirely possible that someone with connections got her that show specifically to deliver that message to people. But one thing he talked about is how certain waves could be weaponized to manipulate certain emotions, tendencies, ideas, thoughts, and you could do these through cell phones. So, you know, essentially you can program people's minds. I mean, not in the strict mind control sense, but you can give people ideas. I
right,
mean,
at very least influence them, because
exactly,
you know, that's how your brain communicates, is with electromagnetic radiation. So, of course, it's intuitive.
Exactly. You have signals, and then, you know, we pressed on saying the people who are most susceptible or people who are on psychotropic drugs or, you know, some kind of barbiturate. And so these can kind of numb certain parts of your brain that might resist some of these tendencies and put you in a place where you're more susceptible to coercion. And, you know, that's kind of a random point. But, you know, it's crazy when you think about the fact that all these signals are just bouncing around all the time, all over, invisible. But in some sense, our brains are picking some of this up. And when you think about the structure of thoughts, you know, this is getting more philosophical, more into the nature, I guess, of consciousness, but they just sort of pop into your head from nowhere. You know, certain things that you do, tendencies that you have, you know, the archetype that you're trying to embody, it changes from time to time. And, you know, part of that, I think, is the people who are around you, the people you spend the most time with. You pick up certain traits, and there are little nuances that you start to adapt. But a lot of it, you know, I think is environmental. We change the way we think. You know, we can be completely different people day to day.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Due to a litany of factors. And so I don't think it's that crazy to say that, you know, in a lot of ways, our minds are computers that can be programmed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could talk forever about just speculating on what the mind is. I mean, my personal take on this is getting really philosophical. But I believe, you know, what we see every day, how we process information, our consciousness is kind of like a shadow on the wall of our eyes produced by our brain to distract us from the fact that it's, you know, just a regular living being. And inside your brain, to you know, credit your point, there are so many things going on in the background that we could never possibly control, you know, while also doing other tasks. Yeah. So all these hormone regulations and emotional outputs, that's all completely chemically dependent. And so if you can find a way to manipulate that, at least trigger some sort of reaction, you know, I'm not sure whether this technology exists. I'm sure governments have invested lots of money in research. I know that you could actually manipulate weather by sending really low frequency radiation into the ionosphere and affect the way that the wind pattern changes, like the Gulf Stream. I don't know if that was ever proven, but I mean, it's the concept is possible. And so I definitely, to credit what you're saying, I think that it's something that could definitely happen without us even knowing it.
Yeah, I think sound waves and vibrational frequencies are everything, far more than we know. And I think that's one thing we really have not tapped into, is understanding how those things affect us. I mean, certain frequencies that you hear affect your brain differently. You know, they can put you in a relaxed state. They can increase your heart rate. You can have godlike experiences by, you know, shooting certain signals into certain parts of your brain. I mean, they did studies where they just stuck a helmet on someone and told them to talk to God, and all of a sudden, you know, there they are, speaking to the man himself.
When you show something, when the brain, in my opinion, when the brain perceives something it doesn't know how to interpret, then that's just that's the most accurate reflection of the person in question that you could ever have. Because there's no ability to manipulate that to produce an output that you want to see or a character that you want other people to see. And so, and that's just kind of a tangential thing, but I agree. I think that anything to do with waves, whether it be the light or sound, the fact that they, I mean, it's clear that they influence us in ways that we can't tell consciously. I mean, a good analogy I think of is a shark in water. A shark can, like the reason that there are no great white sharks in any aquarium is because they die really quickly after being contained, because all of the different levels of minerals and chemicals in the water that they're swimming in affect their senses, and they overwhelm them, they flood them with food, and it messes up the shark's ability to detect one little drop of blood miles away. But the fact that the shark can do that in the ether is kind of related to us. Is you know how insects fly? They're basically floating through water in the air because they're so small. You know, we don't feel like we're swimming all the time, but we're in an ether, and an ether is something that facilitates the sound waves. And I'd be very remiss to hear if our ears were doing anything detecting sound waves. I don't think that's the case at all. But okay, kind of rambling now. But many different rabbit holes you can go down.
Getting into that kind of stuff. I mean, it's pretty reasonable to assume that the government, you know, is 20 to 50 years ahead of most established research. And when you understand the mechanisms by which all this stuff happens, you know, most independent either research institutions or companies. So a company is just researching things to make a profit, essentially. So they're trying to figure out the next big thing that they can make people want. And then you have research institutions that are largely looking more into the ideas and not so much applications. They're moving fairly slowly. They're mostly supported by government grants. And, you know, you have a lot of people who are kind of working. My girlfriend works at a lab at Columbia, and their coffee budget is $10,000 a month. you know, so these are the kinds of people working on those things. But if, you know, within the military, for example, you have a group of, you know, brilliant guys who do nothing but work on something with an unlimited budget for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, you're going to make a lot of headway pretty quickly.
One of my favorite classes I've taken since returning to university has been this class on the executive bureaucracy that I took last semester. And it was a really insightful class because we used statistics and data to prove that there are basically two halves to the bureaucracy. There's one half that a lot of people see in public life, the really incompetent side where all these, it's kind of built into the system. This idea of gridlock in Congress kind of takes on a different role in the executive in the form of bureaucratic delay. But there's also another half to it, an extremely, extremely competent section of the government. And that's everything that's involved with the military and research and hidden services. All of that is so competent that it's like night and day compared to like the post office or the DMV. It's really interesting to study that. And it's actually, you know, backed up by real hard numbers.
Yeah, that's why when you see, you know, the budget for the F-35, you're like, okay, well, what else is Lockheed bundling in with that deal?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they got to make the numbers seem legit somewhere, but, you know, no one knows what it costs to make a fighter jet. People in Congress.
This technology is insane. I mean, when you stop and think about it, just the concept of a drone, not having to see your face to identify you, being able to identify you based on your gait. I mean, something as abstract as the way you walk. I mean, that's so abstract that you wouldn't be able to tell unless you really know somebody. If you see a silhouette, you cannot tell who they are by how they're walking. But the government has technology to do that from, you know, thousands of feet in the air. And so I wonder what else is brewing under the surface in Washington.
Just recently, actually, to take that over to China, they've created this sort of, I don't know what to call it. It's this essentially army of surveillance combined with a citizen credit score. So they have this facial recognition technology that can literally simultaneously analyze the faces of all almost 3 billion people at the same time. And then apply like certain credit ratings to them. So,
right,
you know,
utility
if you get
to society, I mean, it's really interesting how it's like China is a perfect example of determinism in practice and utilitarianism, just showing how that plays out in the country. Everybody's got a unit of worth to the state. But yeah,
Yeah,
continue. Just
and
wanted to
I
inject
think
that
it,
point.
well, yeah, I think it's interesting because it works to a point, you know.
Oh,
If
yeah.
you have this a large group of unorganized people, the best way to create an efficient society and lift yourself out of, you know, what the
But now is that
essentially, yeah, you know, the wrath of communism, you're gonna need to mobilize these people, incentivize them correctly, and sometimes this tyrannical structure is the most efficient way. And people, since they've lived in, you know, such terrible conditions, it seems like the better option, and it probably was then. But now that they're getting to a point where they're more on par with post-industrial civilizations, it'll be interesting to see if the culture is enough to allow these things to play out, if the people are, you know, okay being sort of subjugated and not allowed to share Winnie the Pooh pictures
Oh
online.
yeah, you just hit on the exact point I was thinking of. It's you need two things. You just need a homogeneous population, so you can so there's no variables. Everybody's the same, and you need a complacent population. And you can make an econo any economic system work in that. That's my overall political theory after studying this stuff. That's the only thing I can know for certain after studying it for 2 years. Everything else, I don't know. But it's like why the Nazi economic policies brought Germany out of poverty. I remember you shared an article with me, and I was just almost dumbfounded. I did not know how that their policies actually worked, you know, within the bounds of the country, not
And you
outside,
never hear
obviously.
about that, yeah.
Exactly, you know, but they had a homogeneous population, and obviously that was a platform of the government, and they had a complacent population because they're in such dire need of economic resuscitation that they are willing to give over their rights to the government without even blinking an eye. It's the same with China, I think. I mean, and then to credit your point, I think they're starting to maybe not wake up's not the right word, but at least kind of question, you know, is this really the best system for me as an individual? You know, it's clearly the best system for China as a group of people comprising what was like two, what's their population now? 1.7
It's
billion?
over two, I
It's over
believe.
two. Well, I mean, clearly their strategies were. I mean, what's his name? Who's the
Xi
Xi
Jinping.
Jinping? Yeah, the president for life now.
Oh no, you're
He's
right. It's one
really
point four
solidified a
billion.
position of authority. I don't know. Whatever he's doing is working, but it's not working for the individual. It's working for the collective.
Yeah, and that's to your point before, you know, the homogenous population. I don't think that's necessarily necessary. I think it's been necessary to this point, but really it just has to be a population that feels like there are enough shared values and enough of a sense of community that they all want to work together. They all want to do what's best for the community because they feel like the community will in return do what's best for them. There isn't this every man for himself mentality where it's, you know, step on the guy next to you so that you can
Right.
get ahead.
Yeah, I think we're saying yeah, two sides of the same coin here. When I
Yeah.
say yeah, that's kind of a limiting word, homogenous, that it kind of has a racial implication to it. What I mean is just like you say, like a culture where everybody believes in the same ideals, and actually instead of just holding something in your mind as an abstract ideology and then not practicing in real life, which is kind of what we're seeing in America now.
Yeah.
What I think of cultural homogeneity that facilitates economic systems in practice is the shared values homogeneity, and that historically that's mostly associated with racial homogeneity, but
Yeah.
in the future I don't think it's a prerequisite necessarily. But you have to have something in common, like you're saying. You have to be willing
Yeah, exactly.
to fork over. You know, if you want responsibility, then if you want freedom, you have to accept responsibility. You can't be licentious and go around and misuse your freedoms and then complain that, you know, your freedoms were misused.
Yeah, I mean, you have to forego short-term gratification, you know, for you have to be willing to do
Right.
that, you know, for to support broader society.
That's
It's
literally
something.
the definition of intelligence, the deferral of gratification. And one sets
Yeah.
a and it's embodies in a society, and the society is not going to have any upper limits, which is what the US experienced over the past 200 years, I think.
Well, we're
Experience
slowing
being
down.
past tense,
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've got to get to a point where everyone realizes, and I think the problem is no one's creating a vision of the future that motivates people. You need to give people something to work towards together.
Right.
That's why I think what Trump is doing with, you know, the space program is really smart. You know, never was America more unified than when we fucking landed on the moon. You know, it's how, what better way?
Yeah, you
And
have to be unified, yeah.
yeah,
It's
and when
perfect.
you're, you know, when you're traveling into the deep unknown, suddenly your differences really don't matter much. And that's something that's united people all throughout history is the shared adventure, shared risk, shared conquest, shared exploration, whatever it is. But doing new things together, you know, forces you to work together for some greater goal. And I think we're getting to that point, but people need someone to paint a picture of what that is and how they can get involved. And
exactly. And if you want a role model, you know, don't go seeking YouTube fashion channels unless that's your thing. You know, seek somebody like, and I always say him because he's a quintessential dreamer, and that's Elon Musk. When I listen to his rationale for why he invests his life in basically puts 24 hours of his day or 20 hours of his day into his projects, into his work, and his every last cent is because he has a vision for the future that he wants to enact. And that vision is, well, I want to look into the future and think that it's going to be positive and that we're going to keep making advances. And that's going to require that some people take defer gratification and don't take profit like he is right now, and delay profit gathering to a point where you can get into a new kind of economic frame where it's easier to make revenue off services that might not be profitable in the current era. Just like space travel, as you're saying.
Yeah, and I think you just need to make people realize that that could be you. There's no reason that with this one life you've been given, you can't go be the next Elon Musk. Why not? Like, you know, it's crazy that you would not take the gamble when you have literally everything to lose by not trying and just throwing away, you know, the chance you've been given. It's like, go turn the world into the place you want it to be. And at the end of the day, perception is reality. So if you feel like you're making the world a better place, or you're, you know, spreading some of these positive ideas, you really can make it a better place. Or at the very least, you're going to make your world a better place because you're going to be feeling like you're affecting change. And that's one of the real misconceptions, I think, about all of the information and the censorship, and the argument that these companies are the gatekeepers to society and attitudes and platitudes. You know, each person, I think, can be their own judge of that. They can create their own reality. We constantly do that. Our brains are doing that all the time. And you can deceive yourself into creating a better reality that, you know, that you live in, because everyone's experience, you can be standing next to someone and have a completely different worldview. Just, you know, if you're on, you know, some heroin and you're standing next to some guy who's withdrawing, you are living in entirely different worlds. And so there's no reason you can't create that.
And I think that to bring it back full circle philosophically, taking a step up into a more abstract look at it, I think in order to be able to affect change in the world and bring about a future that you envision and you want to create, you have to truly believe in their deepest heart, not convince yourself. You have to truly believe that what you do can affect your surroundings. You truly believe that the world in the future is capable of being changed for the better, which is why I think that, and this is actually brings back to the YouTube shooter. I won't mention her name because I don't want to give her undue credibility. There's a study in polar opposites, Elon Musk and this YouTube shooter. Elon Musk embraces meaning. His meaning to him is a future where people are drinking clean water, are using clean energy, the pollution is lower, the planet is surviving, people are colonizing the solar system and taking the next step as an evolutionary species. Complete polar opposite to this woman who was driven insane by a lack of meaning, that her worldview that she wanted to enforce by or enact or effectuate via the, you know, purveyance of YouTube videos. She fundamentally believed that she cannot make her vision of the future a reality. And that just drove her directly down into nihilism. I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't diagnose her, but I bet that she took a dive straight down into meaninglessness. And then her last option was, well, you know, there's no possible way for me to change the world, so I'm going to go change it in a negative way, because maybe that will at least give some meaning to my existence.
And, you know, what she should have been thinking is, I'm going to go make a better YouTube. Fuck exactly. Those guys, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to go team up with people who have the same idea as me, and we're going to try to, you know, fight, because that's what the idea of, you know, classical liberalism, which I think the left has strayed far away from, it fundamentally is the belief that everybody is good inherently, that human beings are good. And you have to believe that in order to have faith that a society can prosper. Because if you focus too much on putting, you know, inhibitors to evil in the way, then you also block success, because it's two sides of the same coin. And I think that we need to make sure that our government in our future doesn't mistrust the people. I think it should be the other way around. You know, the government should understand that people are fundamentally good, and the government is there to make sure that those that are bad and that are twisted, like this YouTube woman, don't, you know, become a majority, or don't, you know, change the system, or don't, you know, affect people's pursuit of happiness.
Exactly. They, you know, it's all about giving people the freedom to make their own decisions and not allowing other people to take that freedom away. I think it's that simple.
Yep. Succinct conclusion.
Yep. And with that, I think we'll wrap that up there. That's perfect. And we're going to have another podcast up on Thursday and a following one on Sunday. So tune in for that, guys.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps another one, too. I actually have a person I'd like to interview, so there might be a bonus one in the week to come.
Exactly.
And, keep a lookout for the Atlas Digest, an app launching this week to get your latest news and also be able to follow this podcast.
And as always, you can find more of our news throughout the week on cryptoeconomy.news. And with that, we'll see you next
real
time.
Real fast, okay, go ahead. We should probably announce the launch of the weekly digest.
Yeah, that's something
cool thing that you've done.
Yeah, I just started this last week. I'm just going to take major stories that I've seen throughout the week that I think haven't gotten enough coverage or just things you should know. And consolidating them each Friday so that you can take a look back at the week, see what you might have missed, get our take on some of these issues, and do it really succinctly.
Really like it too because it plays into the podcast, because I really like this podcast as a platform to analyze the news because people already know what's going on. So, you know, if the Weekly Digest plays nicely into this, because if you want to know what we're going to talk about in the podcast and get a little briefing every week with the Weekly Digest, so it's pretty good.
And that's also because the news doesn't really report the news anymore.
Exactly.
So, you know, someone's got to actually think on it. But with that, thanks, guys. I'm going to get some sleep because I haven't slept in about 2 days. So we'll see you guys next time.
Have fun with that.
Yeah.